Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Hardcore Listing. I'm one of your hosts. I'm Stu with him. Chris isn't about, so I'm going to do the intro on my own today. Today's guest, let's cut straight to it. Today's guest is Doc Brown. I heard Doc Brown on Adam Buxton's podcast and on Scroob's podcast and thought, mate, we have got to get this guy on here. He come down to DJ for Pip and I at club night and was cracking. Got on really well with him. Asked him if he'd come on and he was like, love to. So he came down to the Queen of Hoxton and we recorded it in the basement down there. And what a lovely fella. Absolute gent. We had a really good laugh. And as you're probably about to find out, because hopefully you're going to... Listen, you've probably skipped this bit because it's the intro bit and I know you want to go straight to the chat with Doc. But before we do, I'm just going to do a quick few shout-outs to Bang Boom Creative and Love Beer, our sponsors, Mr. 76, who produces this podcast, and the Distraction Pieces Network team. And also on that team, there's two new podcasts. Films We Buried With by Brett Goldstein. Brett is a former guest on Hardcore Listing, and I'm not going to lie, one of my favourite episodes. He's top five was cracking, and he's a lovely man. And his podcast is absolutely smashing it. But it's going to, because Brett's great, and his guests are people like Catherine Ryan, James Acaster, Pip, and... Yeah, it's absolutely gone bananas, this podcast, and rightly so. So go and have a little listen. That's on Acast and iTunes. The other new podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network is a little podcast I'm doing on my own called Off the Beaten Track. It's a music-based podcast where I have a guest on and I ask them seven questions. I send them seven questions in advance of the podcast and they answer them questions with a song selection. And these questions are laid out across their life. So we have a little life story chat, and we talk about the songs that have soundtracked that life to date. But a lot of focus is on the area in which they grew up in and their creative journey and how that area that they grew up in influenced, hindered, affected that creative journey. Had a few episodes out so far. Pip done the first one. We've had Block Party on, Rich Wilson, Snowboy, Destruction. So, yeah, have a little listen to one if you haven't already. If you have listened, thank you, because it was due to you guys listening and supporting that that podcast went to number one on iTunes, which I didn't expect that. You've heard Hardcore Listing, right? We're not very good at this. Like, how on earth did it manage to get to number one? I don't know, but thank you. It felt great. So, that's what's new on the Distraction Pieces Network. And that was a big nod to all my sponsors and stuff. So, let's get back on with the podcast. Queen of Hoxton, thank you very much for letting us record there. It's Doc Brown. It's great. 76, drop that intro music. It's a drunken soiree in the Within. Chris and Stu present Hardcore Listing, the podcast.
Right, we're recording.
So we're at the Queen of Hoxton. Thanks to those people there for letting us record here tonight. And it's a lovely sunny day out there.
Yeah, and we're hanging out in a basement. Yeah.
I think it could be the hottest day of the year.
You reckon?
Yeah.
It feels felt that way. Yeah, it really feels proper hot up there. I went up in the Queen of Hoxton's garden earlier, and it was too hot for me.
It's too much.
I couldn't hack it.
Yeah, you're pretty pasty now.
Yeah, I am.
Your beard looks like it might be, like, you know, borderline ginger.
It's in there.
In this kind of heat, it looks like it'd be highly flammable.
Yeah. That and the combination of all my moles is like the doctor literally is always like,
moly.
Are you staying in this year? And I'm like, well, I might go on holiday. They're like, do not go anywhere sunny. I'm like, oh, thanks, guys.
Well, the voice you heard aside from Chris and I is this evening's guest, which is Doc Brown.
Yeah.
You all right?
Yeah, I'm good. I didn't know what to expect when you said Queen of Hoxton. I suddenly thought halfway here, I thought, oh shit, maybe there's a crowd. Because it's a venue. Yeah, do you know what I mean? I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I've been in that situation before where, like, I still turned up. Because I thought, like, if it's a crowd, I'll just turn it on. I'll be, 25% funnier. With a bit more energy. I've been in that situation before where both ways, where I expected a crowd and there's nobody. Yeah. And when I didn't think there was a crowd, and suddenly there's a crowd. And, I suppose it changes your energy when you're on the mic. But I'm glad you haven't even attempted to get a crowd. Because... Yeah. It is, like we said, it's the hottest day of the year so far. I've been involved in a couple of events recently that have been postponed at the last minute or cancelled because no fucker wants to go indoors.
Yeah, definitely.
So
it's a rough one that I think when you start promoting and it's a sunny day, you're like, yes, this is going to be great. And then no one's showing up. What the fuck's going on?
There are multi-million dollar budget blockbusters that have flopped in the past just because of the sun.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
You throw the sun in there, and then you throw the World Cup in there.
Yeah, I had a rough night at 93 feet east.
I feel sorry for comedians right now. They're struggling. That first act who's on at like 7:30 right now on the circuit. Oof.
There's no one there.
Oof. Iran, Portugal. Yes, please.
So you've chosen a really decent five, Ben. But you sent over a few others as well.
Yep.
To kind of...
Yeah, I thought I'd give you guys some options. Do you know what I mean? Because I'm not... I don't like to be precious about stories. I don't like to be precious about anything that I do. Because I think the more fun you can have with your work, the better the work is. And the more you can move on, the more you experience and the more you experiment. So I just... Same with everything. I just go, hey, we could talk about this, we could talk about that. So I sent a little list. And I was just looking back over it when you were off getting me a drink. And I realised that some were quite good, but some, like, I mean, top five Muppets. I don't know how we could have stretched an hour out of that one.
We'd make it.
You reckon?
Yeah, we'll do that for part two.
I always, for sure. When people, like, I always think one of the most horrific things you could ever see would be that kind of Muppet factory where they're all just...
I literally went to one on Friday.
Fuck off.
Really? I went to one on Friday, yeah. I just got involved in this thing. I was involved in a puppet show years ago, a TV puppet show called Big Babies, which was just amazing.
Yeah.
I was doing some voices. And the puppeteers that worked on that, they've gone on to do all these amazing things. They've got a new TV series that they're working on. And they said, do you want to come and try out some voices? And I was like, yeah, of course, man, definitely. And I went to their studio, and it's the puppet graveyard vibes.
It's
so freaky, but at the same time, it's pretty cool, man.
Yeah.
I have to say. Like, just the level of creativity it blows you away.
Yeah.
I love working with puppets. Did you know there's a new puppet movie coming out where there's like, I think it's got Melissa McCarthy in it. Yeah, it has. And it's like, it's humans and puppets. But it's like a totally adult film, and her and a puppet detective, they're police, and they're investigating murders in this puppet town.
Oh, amazing. But it's not like a Roger Rabbit style. It's going to be more serious than that, is it?
No, that's the thing. It's going to be comedy. It's like hardcore sex, hardcore violence, and comedy. It might be the worst film ever, or it might be the best.
It might be glorious, yeah.
Check out the trailer, right? The trailer ends with a Muppet... having a multiple orgasm, just ejaculating all over an office.
What's it called? Yeah.
I can't. If you look up
Spunkin' Rabbit.
Yeah. look up Melissa better. McCarthy, Puppet, Mayhem.
Orgasm.
Yeah, it's mental. Like, the trailer is just like, what? Like, because they are Muppets. Like, yeah. They're made by Brian Henson. There's some legal stuff that's going on between Brian Henson and his dad's own company, because the company, the Muppets company, are like, we don't want to be anywhere near this thing.
Yeah, of course.
But when you watch the trailer, it's like, yeah, it could be the best or the worst movie in the history of movies.
So would you have done top five Puppets or specifically Muppets?
No, it would have been specifically Muppets. Yeah, right.
Throw a few in. Who would have been in there?
Say again? Who would have been in it?
Throw a few in there.
Well, I didn't really think about it in detail when I was when I put it in there. I just threw it in there because I thought it might be funny. But I'd say Gonzo would have to be in there.
What is Gonzo?
Don't know. He's got a dick for a nose, right?
Anteater, maybe? Skinny anteater?
Maybe, yeah.
I'd never really thought about what Gonzo was.
Yeah.
You got to have Fuzzy in there, I'd say. Even though Scooter is boring, I like him.
Mainly because I can do his voice almost perfectly.
That's good. I really like Scooter. And, Miss Piggy. I mean, like, Rolf?
Rolf,
yeah. I like because he really played the piano.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he had human hands.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just the Muppets for me were, that was like the Simpsons before the Simpsons, do you know what I mean?
See, before the Christmas one, I remember just one of the weirdest things, and I used to cycle to school every day when I was a kid, and my mate Paul was literally, when we was at school, about 6 foot, but he must have been about 4 stone, right? And his parents bought him, when mountain bikes first come out, bought him this massive mountain bike. And have you ever seen Kermit the Frog ride a bike?
Yeah.
I think it's in like the Muppet Caper,
it's
I think.
It's so good how they animate that.
It's mental, isn't it?
Yeah, just those
that's what
sticks.
He looked like.
And the bony knees going round and round.
It looks like there's no muscles functioning there, does it?
That's hilarious.
Who'd be one of your Muppets then, mate?
Animal's got to be in there, right?
Animal is a good show. Yeah.
Animal's pretty, Beaker's pretty cool.
Beaker.
Like, if you see the Christmas Muppet Carol, when him and the Doctor knock on the door, begging like for charity money at Christmas, and Michael Caine shuts the door and throws something at him. The doctor guy picks up the coins, and you got to look carefully. Beaker gives him the finger.
Wow,
really?
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Beaker, I'd go for. But people used to buy me dolls of Beaker as a kid because I've literally just got my neck and my head are equally as wide.
Yeah.
So I look a bit like Beaker.
Yeah, you are. I would say if I had to break you down, you're 20% neck.
It is. It's a tough look, that one. It's a hard one to
Ronaldo's
look.
A bit like that, isn't he? Cristiano Ronaldo. Yeah. But I think that's maybe because he's built up his neck so much that it's sort of caught up with the width of his head.
Yeah, my skull
you
just
haven't,
was
though,
shrunk.
Have you?
Yeah, just shrunk. Miss Piggy. I've got to give it props to Miss Piggy. And I kind of like Pepe Le Prawn as well. I think he's a new addition. He's all right. Yeah, I think he's funny, man. I think he's got something.
Left field edition.
Yeah.
I like that.
And before we get on to your five, I just want to pick your brains quickly, Ben, about 60s, 70s soul classics that people might not have heard of.
Oh, yeah, that was on there as well.
So I'm curious as to what a couple of those
might be. Oh, man. The Other Side of Town by Mandrill is an unbelievably great album. I love hearing like those old albums, particularly when you hear a little, if you're a big rap fan, you hear a little loop on there, like a little something, a vocal sample, or you know, a little strum of the guitar that you recognize from somewhere. I love that. But even more, I just love stumbling across stuff that you've got no business knowing anything about. I say Al Green's album, Call Me.
Nice.
Oh,
that is just, that's probably quite well known, but I mean, it doesn't have maybe the more well-known hits on it, but song for song, it's like flawless.
As a vocalist, outrageous.
Yeah.
Different level.
Sure. Yeah. He's different gravy. Like, as soon as you hear his voice, you just relax. It does something to you. It's like it's spiritual. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a great album by a guy called Rufus Thomas, called
Rufus Thomas Dunn Seesaw with Aretha Franklin.
He worked with loads of really
big people. Was that Rufus Thomas Rufus as in Chaka Khan and Rufus?
He worked with loads of big people, but he wasn't really like a he was a star, but he wasn't like a star because he's just such a he looks like a penguin. He's got like this crazy receding hairline with a big sort of grey afro at the back. Like he looks a mess.
Yeah.
But he's one of the funkiest men alive. He's got an album called Did You Heard Me, which I like in itself, Did You Heard Me. And there's all sorts of like the funkiest breakbeats you ever heard on that. The drums are so fucking hard. It's like he's turned the drums up in the mix and just gone, look, fuck it. This drum pattern's so ridiculous. We need to just raise it up. There's a song on there called The Funky Penguin, which is like, it's too much. There's to be fair, there's endless albums. I could sit here talking about them for ages, but it might start distancing certain listeners. Do you know what I mean? That's why I think you pick the right one. Actually, just the last word on 60s and 70s albums. Remember when my girlfriend, now wife, was helping clear out her uncle's flat. It's on a little housing estate in Islington. He was moving away. We were helping him clean it out. And we shifted like this chair and sofa, and there was like a little cabinet behind there. So we were getting ready to shift that, but it was just so heavy we couldn't move it. And he was like, oh, I'll just see what's in it. And we opened it up, and it was like Stax and Atlantic records from the mid-60s to like the mid-70s. So the best era for both of those labels. But they were unplayed, somewhat unopened.
So what? You still get that little feeling when you pull it out for the first time and it's still stuck to the inner sleeve.
Yeah. So they look like reissues, you know, but they're all originals. And we were just like, what are you doing with these? And he was like, oh, I totally forgot they were there. Just have them, man. So me and my wife inherited those, and there's a treasure trove in there. It's about 150 records.
Nice.
It's a great era. If you're into soul and funk, it's an untouchable era, really. Yeah. They don't really make soul like that anymore, apart from maybe Charles Bradley. Don't know if you heard him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's amazing. But yeah, it's like a musical form that has actually gone.
Mm. You came down and DJ'd for us a couple of, what was that, about a month ago now?
Mm-hmm.
And you did a vinyl set, which our guests rarely do that. And it was, you mixed it all in, man. It was wicked. I don't know if you started with Got To Be Real. I think I was taking a slash when you started playing that.
It was early on.
Oh, my God. And then you mixed in, I think, Never Too Much, Luther Vandross. It was good.
I said to Ben when you was having a slash again, this evening,
I spend a lot of time in those.
It was just so good. This girl come up and just went, I don't suppose you've got any Luther Vandross, and literally just turned around and just pulled it straight out on vinyl, flipped it over and put it on. And I was like, yeah, that was smooth.
I think it's a thing now. When I speak to DJs that I know, and there's a lot of DJs I knew from back in the day who are like big DJs now, I guess. And it's a thing now where we'll do a vinyl night. We'll do it like everyone has to play vinyl. It's like an event in itself.
Yeah.
And it's like a novelty.
Yeah.
This wasn't that. Like, I really wanted to do it, but as all I had is vinyl. I was saying, Stu, like, it's been so long since I DJ that they've invented a new way to DJ since the last time I DJ. They've invented Serato.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
CDJs. So, like, yeah, I was like a house party DJ. You know, I just, like, my thing was always just play what everybody wants to hear. But over the course of my life, my collections got mad. Like, it's so varied. And there's a bit of everything. Like, I dream of the day one day where I could play to a crowd of, like, proper, proper rap nerds. Do you know what I mean? Who, like, know everything there is to know about rap. Because then I could play whatever the fuck I wanted for my collection, and everybody would know about it. My records they go deep. And when I flick through them, because I never have a reason to flick through them, that was the best thing about getting that gig. I had a reason to flick through them again. So it was like a day of like putting on songs whilst I was getting the little selection together. It was lovely. That's exactly what I was about to say.
Yeah.
It was like a page from a diary, do you know what I mean? I was like, fuck this, you know what I mean? And that, and jeez, oh man, this reminds me of so.
Yeah,
so, yeah, it's special. I came close to getting rid of it all, maybe about 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't do it. Yeah. I tried. In the end, I just got all the like doubles and shit that was given to me, promos and shit that I bought that was just awful.
Yeah.
I got like 300 of those and took them down to Oxfam. And that felt good, like a little purge.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm glad I didn't get rid of it all.
Yeah, I could never get rid of mine. It drives my missus up the wall, but like literally whenever we...
Well, that's because you won't move them out of the bedroom. There's no room for anything else. It's just in different piles.
We literally, like it was part of our criteria whenever we move house. It's like if the house we're in now hasn't got a loft, but like... It was always a big thing that like, we've got to have a loft because I've got to fit it out so I can put my decks and my vinyl there.
Yeah.
And like, so now obviously I've got the room at the end of the garden.
Yeah.
Which is great because whenever my missus has a go at me, she's like, just get out of my sight. I'm like, that's sweet.
Yeah, I've got one of those, the little man shed at the end of the garden. I can record in there and it's real peaceful, it's nice and cozy, but there's a shitload of vinyl in there as well. I'm fortunate in that my wife's a vinyl nut as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, she spent about £300 on Prince records a few months ago.
That's money well spent, right?
Yeah,
that's what I think. She's like a huge Prince fan, so when he died, she was like cut up and she just did everything Prince related. She's seen him like 16, 17 times. She's hardcore.
Man, he must have been hard.
I was in Austria and he died on my birthday. And I remember just getting up in this like little hotel room and just putting the telly on and I was like, there's no way Prince is dead. And like, I thought, that's got to be like early doors rumour mill. It can't be true. And fucking Prince was dead. He was like, man.
Like, yeah, it felt like out of the blue, didn't
he? He's like young, surely. Yeah. He's going to live forever. He's Prince. Yeah. Like, oh, man, that's awful. Awful.
Yeah.
Well, let's move away from that sombre subject and let's talk about what top five you did pick. Ben, what'd you go for?
Well, I sent you guys a list and I sort of left it up to you to pick your favourite and the vote came back top five worst gigs. So yeah. I've noticed that's a top five or a bottom five. I don't really work that one out. top five worst gigs, and it's specifically stand-up, which we haven't mentioned yet, because you know I've had some bad like music gigs, but music's so different. Like I remember I was in a band with Mark Ronson for a bit, and I remember playing.
Was your first gig at like Fabric or something like that?
Yeah, the first one was at Fabric, A few months after that, we played. It was either Isle of Wight Festival or Bestival. It was definitely on the Isle of Wight.
And this was an all-star lineup, right?
Yeah, fucking all-star lineup. Yeah. And it was like I don't know, maybe 40,000 people. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
And in the band was Amy was in the band,
yeah,
right?
Amy Winehouse, Lily Allen. Yeah, all sorts of people.
Jimmy requires bassist as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuart Zender. Yeah.
Santo Gold.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. She was in it.
Haggis Horns.
Oh,
Haggis Horns. Snowboy on percussion. It was like, it was ridiculous.
Really?
Snowboy.
Snowboy done my podcast last week.
Did he?
He's a really good friend of mine.
Oh, he's a lovely guy.
He's an Essex boy.
Is he?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that. Yeah, man. So, yeah, I mean, it's just a ridiculous amount of talent in there and me. And, I remember one gig we did there, came out on stage. One of the mics was fucked up. Like, I think it was either Lily's or Amy's, wasn't working at all. Mark used, because we had Snowboy doing all the multi-percussive stuff, but not actually a drum kit, so to speak.
Yeah.
Mark would just have the drums on a CD and play it on a CDJ, just the drums mastered like that, boom. So give it a sort of hip-hop vibe. That was fucking up. And there was like all these technical difficulties. You just look at it, it's just 40,000 people just going, even when like they try and apologize. Oh, sorry for ignore that last song, blah, blah. We got a few issues. No one cares. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Whereas in stand up, it's like the tiniest things can completely destroy a gig.
Yeah.
In spectacular fashion. Do you know what I mean? So I thought it was probably more interesting to talk about.
So you're five.
It's got to be more pain. It's got to be more cringy and painful when you're just there's hung out.
And there. You're on your own, right? You're not in a band. You're out there on your own.
It's your idea, and you've gone, hey, this is funny, right? And then everyone's just like, And people are like, no, that's not funny.
You know what? It turns my stomach a little bit just hearing you say that. Just hearing it referred to in any way. It's such a horrific, horrific job. I don't know why anyone would do it. You'd have to be a sadomasochist.
So you've sent five over, right?
Yeah.
Are they from like bad to tragic, or are they just five howlers?
I wrote them down as I remembered them, right, so sure. They're not in an order.
Okay, that's okay. Cool.
Because like I think I gave you as number five was probably one of the most horrifying, but it was also different because only I really knew what was going on. So it's kind of a unique situation, that one. But no, I was just writing them down in no particular order, really. Thinking, what are the five worst moments I can remember? And I'm sure there's more that I've forgotten about, but those are the ones that came to mind.
These are the ones that you haven't buried.
Yeah. It's hard to move on. Because like 90% of the time in my career as a stand-up, I must have been killing it. Because I was making a healthy living.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? People was coming to my gigs. I never had empty rooms. You know, did well.
Yeah.
So I must have been generally good.
Yeah.
But I can't remember any times where I was like, oh yeah, that was the best gig of my life. I remember every death.
Well, you've got no recollection of coming off thinking, slayed that.
I definitely did it, loads. Yeah. But I couldn't like pinpoint, oh, this gig, this place, what it was like before, afterwards. Something about dying, it just focuses the brain in a weird way. And I remember every element, like little things that happened before, little things that happened after, what the rooms were like. Do you know what I mean? It's weird.
Yeah. Brilliant.
But sometimes in extreme moments of life, the brain does operate in a strange way. Like if you think about like high octane moments of your life, like when some shit like really crazy happens, you get hit by a car, or you get a phone call and one of your friends has died, or like first time you kiss a girl, or you know what I'm saying? Like first time you get super high, or whatever it is, like those big moments in life, your brain's, you're just on another plane. You know what I mean? You're operating in a different kind of emotional zone where everything is heightened. I think that's what it is. Killed it so often that it was water for duck's back. Don't remember those days. I just murked it again. I'm hilarious success. Again. Of course I am.
I think when you do any new experience, seems to time stretches for it, doesn't it? Yeah. Whereas when you're doing things that you've routinely done, your brain doesn't need to store that information. It's not new. But if you're dying, it's weird because it's the same thing. You call it dying like on stage, but also anything that might threaten you as a person. Mm. We're probably programmed to remember that more because you don't want to sort of be back in that situation.
So you're saying it's almost like the survival instinct of a human being. Fight or flight, isn't
it? Yeah, I guess so. But yours is telling a sucky joke, basically.
Yeah. It's interesting that it's called killing and dying.
Yeah.
You kill and you die. You kill or you die. That's quite mad.
Well, let's not focus on you killing it. Can we just really go into you just dying on your ass, please?
So I guess I'll start with that first one I remembered. I was in the Midlands. And I guess what you got to understand about this period of my life is I was a couple years into working the circuit and I was gigging 11 or 12 times a week.
When was this roughly?
This is like 2009, maybe 2010. And I'm gigging for a living. That's what I'm doing. Nothing else. I'm just performing. I'm writing jokes and I'm performing them. And, you know, the gigs are like, occasionally you'll get a decent payer, but on the whole, the gigs are like, you know, it's like £150 or maybe £200. So you got to keep doing it. Like I had two kids. Do you know what I mean?
And you got to get to these gigs, right?
To the gigs. So like you got a gig in Newcastle for £150. You got to get there and back and sleep somewhere.
Yeah.
So you're not really seeing a lot of that £150. Sometimes you end up like negative equity.
Yeah. There's no pension involved in that.
No,
either.
People don't really appreciate like what the grind is for stand up. It's insane. If you're gonna make it, you've got to do so many horrible gigs. This one was not a particularly horrible gig, but I was in a particularly difficult place because when you got really young kids, if you're a live entertainer, your life becomes quite fraught quite quickly. So, like, my missus would come home from work teaching, and it would be like a sort of just a high five, you know, that would be it. And I'd be out the door because I needed to get to fucking Stafford or something. Do you know what I mean? In time for an evening gig. So it was fraught with a lot of tension, and you got these two kids and whatnot, and you're always really tired. So it's easier to get into arguments with your other half. So I was at the side of the stage, and we started a conversation on the phone, and it quickly had become quite fraught.
Oh.
And then it was like, oh God, I'll deal with it. You know, I'll be home and I'll deal with it when I get home. And then they're like, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage, Doc Brown. And I was just like, oh, I just hung up. Like, and I hadn't done any of my sort of ritual prep, which for me is always like emptying my pockets. Like, I don't like having anything on me.
Yeah.
Ever. I don't know what it is. Similar to how I started to be quite uncomfortable having short sleeves on stage. Maybe I felt too naked or something. But yeah, I'd never want things in my pockets. Never want money in my pockets. Didn't want to jangle. But yeah, I hadn't done my checks. I went on stage and I was in a bad mood and I wasn't mentally prepared to do comedy. So I had an awkward start. And your start is everything. You know, the first thing you say, it puts an audience at ease or it puts them on edge. If it puts them on edge, that's fine if the second thing you say pulls them back from the brink. If the second thing you say is also awkward, they're right out there on the edge. And then you might get a third strike. Do you know what I mean?
Is there any way really back from that? If you get like,
it's really tricky.
Yeah.
It's really tricky because what will happen is humans read humans. Even though we might think we're not great readers of body language, right? It's like the two guys that came in when we were just about to start recording. Yeah. They wanted to use the room at the same time,
yeah,
but we had it booked.
Mm-hmm.
If you looked at their body language, there's two guys. One of them was adamant he wanted to check some equipment for this other guy.
Yeah.
If you looked at the body language, the other guy didn't really give a shit.
Went, no, he wasn't mind. Bothered. Yeah, yeah.
He was quite easy. And sure enough, when he spoke, he was like, I don't mind doing it tomorrow.
Yeah.
But the first guy's body language was very much like, I have to do this yep. now. And you could read that without being a psychologist. So on stage, it's like every fucker is staring at you, reading your language, even though they might not know they're doing it. So it's little things, it's the whites of your eyes, it's your hands, it's the way you're carrying yourself.
So your bad day can really voice. Resonate then.
Yeah. So first of all, there was a tension that I must have gave off, and then that was thrown back at me. And normally I would say, I would do like a bit of, I don't know, a bit of off the cuff banter with the crowd, just, you know, what's going on, you know, your town shit, whatever. And I was just like, not in the mood. I was just up there like, this is annoying that I have to do this now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And
going for the motions.
Yeah. And I think the first thing I said was like, all right. And a couple of people were like, hey, I'm like, yeah. You guys, yeah, you're in. So what's going on? That's enough. Just the awkwardness of that is enough to completely throw a room. You yeah. better come with a joke soon. And I didn't. I launched into material. It felt contrived immediately because of the sudden switch. To joviality.
Yeah.
And I became awkward in my body language almost immediately. I was wearing like a thin jacket over a t-shirt with jeans. And I subconsciously, because I had mic in my left hand, with my right hand, I just put my hand in my pocket. And in my pocket, like I felt what felt like a handkerchief. I don't know what I thought it was. Your brain's doing lots of different things when you're doing stand-up. If you're improvising, you're completely in the moment. Your brain's only really doing one thing. It's right. very pure. It's interesting. But if you're doing material that you do every night, your brain can wander in a crazy way. You know, when you were first started to drive, you never would have believed yeah. that you could think about anything yeah. other than driving.
Yeah. yeah.
But then now you get somewhere and you can't remember the journey
at all.
Now you're
like eating a fucking hot dog. Yeah. You know what I mean? Arguing with your kids. So, yeah, I was there thinking, oh, what's that? What's that in my pocket? I pulled it out thinking it was a hanky. I don't know why I pulled it out even. I was half in, half out of the situation. And I looked at it, pair of three-year-old girl's knickers in my hat. And I just like, my body just froze up. I looked out at the crowd and I must have gone white as a sheet and looked at them. I've not really revealed what it is to them. I've just got it, I just shoved it back in.
Oh.
And then I died for 17 minutes straight because I just wasn't in the moment. I wasn't in the zone. I was just thinking, like, did anybody see that I've got
knickers
on me?
Are these?
How do I explain the fact that, you know, because those early stages of comedy, you're not really you on stage. You develop an act. Do you know what I'm saying? And then the act is a version of you. So you choose what you want to give away about yourself. So there'll be some comics that you'll meet. You'll be like, "Rat, I never knew this guy had a family." Mm. Or, "I never knew this guy was gay." You know? Yeah. They choose what they're going to show you about themselves, you know? And at that stage, I think I talked about having kids, definitely. But I hadn't really, like...
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Eased into who I was, which is when your comedy gets better. So I didn't really have a plan B for situations like that. If that happened a couple of years down the line, I would be like, this is gold. I'm using this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? This might look weird to you, but let me just hold on a minute before you call the authorities. But for me at that moment, I was like, this is the ultimate nightmare. And whilst we talk about killing and dying in comedy, you can also talk about suicide, because sometimes you kill yourself, right? Sure. It's so weird. Sometimes everything's laid out for you to be funny.
Yeah,
and for everything to go fine.
Yeah, well, the crowd but seems warmed up and
jovial.
Yeah,
you second guess yourself.
Yeah.
You get in your own head.
Yeah,
and then you kill yourself.
Yeah, self-fulfilling.
It's mad, yeah. And that's exactly what happened. I was just like, "There's no way back from this." Whereas I don't think anybody in that audience, I'd be amazed if anyone saw. Well, they probably just thought I was a sweat rag. You know?
Yeah.
Weird that he didn't mop his brow; just took it out, put it back in. But yeah. Other than that, fine.
Yeah,
you know,
subliminally flashed it to us.
Yeah.
All.
But these are the margins that you're dealing with. And, you know, this isn't actually on the list, but it just reminded me. I did an hour and a half at the Bloomsbury doing my own show. I was very, very nervous. Never done my own show to that big a crowd. And the night before, I'd opened the garage door into my own face. So I had this huge lump and a gash across my forehead. Yeah. And I've got a big forehead. So I kept thinking to myself before I went on, just go on and say something like, you know, all these years of writing jokes and trying to be funny. And I don't think I'll write anything or perform anything tonight that would be as naturally funny as opening a garage door onto my own face. You know, just say that, get it out of the way, because you've got a massive thing there. And I forgot to say that.
Yeah.
I did an hour and a half. I was filming it, three cameras. And I've never used the footage. because the gigs, it's okay, but it's not that good. And it's because for an hour and a half, people aren't really connecting with me. They're looking at my head and going, why isn't he saying anything about his head?
Yeah, own it. And there's an elephant in the
room. And in stand-up terms, it becomes like, I don't believe anything this guy's saying.
Yeah.
Because he's got a fucking golf ball on his head with a massive cut above it, and he's pretending it's not there.
Yeah, of course.
So nothing else he's saying is probably true, or when he's improvising, it's not real improvising.
Why doesn't he want to talk about
Why doesn't he want to talk about it?
Domestic issue that's happened today.
Yeah. It's mad, isn't it?
Being funny, if you say you walked into a door, they're like, oh, right, yeah. Everyone walks into doors, don't they? That's the textbook go-to excuse, and he walked into a door.
I had to reference it, and I didn't. The knickers was a bit like that. I should have just said something, owned it, and it would have been fine.
Yeah.
But that's the nature of the business. It's incredibly delicate. No one else is in control other than you. And unless you're feeling uber confident, like the god of that room, there's all sorts of things that can go badly wrong. You know, I've turned situations like that to my advantage. Since you know,
do you think it's because you're more confident?
It's because you have more experience.
Yeah.
I went to a gig in Brighton once, and I was super late. The host was having to, you know, pad out and do more and more improv and stuff. Got there, went backstage. The stage manager was like, "Mate, we're gonna get you straight on." I was like, "Cool, cool, cool." Left me there backstage, and the host started to announce me, and I was just like, "Cool, I think I'm okay." Wipe the sweat off my brow, Doc Brown. And I was like, I actually don't know the way. I don't know the way to the stage.
Spinal tap.
Yes, proper spinal tap shit. I was like, I never asked that crucial question. How the fuck do I get on? Like, and everyone's clapping and it calms down. And he's like, where the fuck is he? And I can hear everything that's going on. So I'm just like trying to follow the noise. Whip open this one door and it's literally a cupboard. It's literally a broom cupboard. There's brooms and mops in there. Fuck. So I run to the end. There's another corridor. I run to the end of that corridor. I can hear. I'm like, I know I must be. There's a wall and there's the crowd. I can fucking hear him. So I run to the other end of this corridor, open the door, and it's like at the back of the room. It's like cabaret seating, and everyone's sat there with their meals and stuff, and I'm just there by the tables. And he's like,
did you open the door loud enough that they turned around and looked?
Yeah, everyone around me turned and looked, and he was like, the coach was like, I'm sorry about this, guys. I don't know where he is. And I was like, oh, no, I'm over here. I'm just here. He was like, what the fuck are you doing over there? And I was like, I don't know. I couldn't find my way on stage. So this is getting like huge laughs. And then I get like an extra round of applause walking down to their mic. And then I can spend the first 5 minutes talking about it.
Yeah,
that's great.
And it's just like, that was a huge lesson in like, if there's adversity, just air it out.
Yeah.
Because if you're in a room of silence and everyone's focused on one thing and something other than the one thing happens, for you not to reference that makes you look like a sociopath.
Yeah.
It makes you look weird.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it was a huge lesson that. But yeah, it's funny how talking about gigs just reminds me of other gigs.
Do you feel that? Do you ever, like, you've written something and you're a bit nervy and you're like, fucking hell, like, I think this is really funny, but it is a bit close to the bone. And then does that then affect your sort of, when you're in, because it's material you've got, so it's something you're not improvising, so it could come out before you could even regret saying it, I guess, and it might bomb or it might be funny. But if it's material that you've pre-planned, are you worried, is there ever, like, I've got to just tank this, I've just got to be confident and just say this shit? Because if there's any element of me being nervous about saying what I'm going to say, the crowd's going to pick up on it, and they're going to get a weird vibe off me.
Mm.
And
it's a really good question, and I suppose the short answer is yes. Like, it's always scary to say something that you haven't said before, and it's like double scary if it's something that could be seen as maybe controversial or like. The thing is. This is the reason I hate people recording you at gigs, because if I'm doing something new and they record it and they put it online and it's shit, everyone's like, wow, why is he saying that?
Yeah.
And you're thinking, hold on, in 6 months, this is going to be amazing.
Record it then. It's taken out of context, right?
Yeah. So it's even harder when you're you're just working out where the funny is, you know, yeah. on stage. You're working it out. So there can be some awkward moments en route. So I was in Manchester and I was talking about terrorists because it was so close to the atrocities that happened at the arena.
Yeah.
I was given no time to get where I was going. Yeah. And that was not the audience's fault. It was my fault for thinking I can do a relatively serious setup to a funny guy. I haven't got that kind of time.
I haven't got
that kind of time. Like, as soon as you mention certain key words, people are going to take it a certain way. And then there's huge pressure on the punchline when it comes as well, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I persisted with that because I thought there was something in it, even though it really tanked the first time I was talking about it. And I thought, you know what, just come at it with pure honesty tomorrow. Like, just come back at it and say what you want to say about it in as natural a way as possible, rather than trying to write it down and make the joke technical, because that's never been a strength of mine. I've always been a conversational kind of comic. And that's exactly what I did. I just came back and I said, he's fucking terrorists, you know, like, I hate them and I resent them. You know what I'm saying? I hate them, obviously, for the atrocities and whatnot. But I also resent them because, as like a Afro-Caribbean male, they kind of took away our edge a little bit. Do you mean we used to have a little something going before these pricks?
And what Chris was saying earlier about, like, you know, when you're thinking of a joke and you're putting it together, you think, oh, is that close to the line? Like, what was your sort of response, like, when you first sort of read the scripts for what Ricky was going to do with you in the film and with, you know, Quality Street and stuff like that? How did you sort of digest that? And, you know, was there, you know, pros and cons to it in your own mind? And
the Ricky thing was just mad from the start, really, because first of all, he phoned my phone out of the blue. He got my number from someone else, and he asked me to come and open for him. And we started talking from then about stuff. And the first thing we did together was Derek. And so that was 2012. And to be honest, everything I've worked on him with, in terms of, like you say, scripts and stuff, the scripts have been a blank page. So he'll have the setup, like where the scene's going to take place, and a rough idea of what's going to be said. And then you sort of workshop it. So you kind of work it out together. And the film was like that. There was just whole scenes where it was just like, all right, this is going to be the vibe. Let's see if we can get there. Sometimes there was like really funny lines that were written down. But a lot of the time he was like, what would you say if Brent says this, what would you say then? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was the same with Derek. Derek even more so was massively improvised. So you just sort of give you the character, give you the situation, and then you go for it. And if you came up with something really funny in the moment, then he'd go, yeah, that, but just like a bit shorter, say this word instead of that word, and then that's how you'd shoot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, with him, it was like always like a fascinating process, but scary as well, because there's a part of me that I know, like in under pressure, I can do things off the cuff like that can work. But when you're making a movie or a TV show, it's a bit like, no, I want to fucking know. Like, I want to know it's going to be good and it's going to work. I don't really want to improv right now. Because it's going to be there for everybody to see forever. But yeah, he sort of made it feel like a safe place to do that kind of experimentation. It was always exciting to do it.
Is that because he's always pissing himself? Because I always feel like with Ricky,
gives you confidence.
It goes back to that confidence thing that you were talking about earlier, and being in the zone and being in the right mindset. If you're having that much of a laugh and you're dicking around, I've got certain mates where I can't behave myself because we get hysterical quickly and things get silly. But that is also when the funniest shit I feel comes out.
Yeah, I think that's true of Ricky. You know, they say like one of the number one rules for making comedy, film or television is that you shouldn't have too much fun, because then it always comes across as a bit like self-aggrandizing and everyone's having a good time except me. I'm watching it. Do you know what I mean? I'm the one paying for it. And I think there is truth in that, but also there is a camaraderie amongst funny people. Like if they can make each other laugh and make the crew laugh or make the other actors laugh and whatnot. There's something in that. There is something in that. And if you can bottle it so it doesn't get boring, then even better. And Ricky, he's definitely a one for like couple takes and done. Do you know what I mean? We're not doing this fucking thing all day. Mm. That's why he always finishes early. And so in the business, people love him because he, most shoots, you know, finish at the work 7 till 7 and Ricky will be like 9 till 4.
Okay, so should we get on to number 4?
Yeah, I can't even remember what it is. actually, I've got them here. What was it? Oh, yeah. Yeah, this was just a good old-fashioned death at Leicester Square Theatre. Where I've continually died over the years. And this was one where there were some rowdy Glaswegians in the second row and they just rattled me.
Yeah.
Not saying anything mean. They were just like not really paying attention. They're quite loud, having conversations. And again, you know, a lot of these deaths come from the early stages because I just didn't have a gear change. I didn't have a way to deal with it. So I just sort of struggled along. You know, this bit of material, that bit of material, none of it works. And it's probably because the audience is looking at me going, mate, tell them to shut the fuck up. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, and you're not. So it gets to the end. I always know I've had a bad gig because I'll say something like, that's my time. Yeah. You know, that was just not a way to end the gig. That I've done the 20 minutes I was contracted to do.
So.
Hey, thank you very much. They got to the end of the 20, sort of smattering of applause, painful, like, oh God, just that feeling of finality, like they couldn't wait for me to just go and get the host back on. And I couldn't wait to get the fuck out of there. So I turned, this stage was like long and narrow, big, heavy set theatrical curtain behind me. So I turned to get through the curtain, I just pushed it aside, and to my horror, that wasn't where the gap was in the curtain. So like I shuffled along the curtain a little bit and pulled at it again, and that the gap wasn't there either. So then I panicked immediately. I thought either I reach again to my right or I just have to shuffle back to the left and I'm definitely gonna look lost. I went for the third option, I shuffled back to the left, and I still couldn't fucking find it.
And it was
just, so, I can't express, like, the pain of it, the horror. I had nothing, I just felt so empty, and I just thought, I'm never coming back here, I'm never doing comedy again, so it doesn't matter what the fuck happens next. And I just got down and crawled under it. And got the fuck out of there.
I'd love to have seen that, man.
And when I was behind the curtain, I heard the host go back on. He goes, oh, that's a bit embarrassing, wasn't it? Anyway, our next act is... Oh, God.
To hear that as you're like leaving the joint as well. Because there's nothing worse than, you know, people are watching you and you're fucking up. Like, you're doing something that normally you do effortlessly, but you can't negotiate a door. It might be a step. Well, you had a bit of a... You bailed out, didn't you, the other day? You told me you stacked it in the middle of the high street.
This is amazing, man.
I
could take that.
It was in the middle of fucking Liverpool Street Station. And that's never a mellow place to be.
No, it's not. Tucked out away.
I've done full splits whilst trying to hold.
Were you running for a train?
No, I was out of my wife and we was walking back through Liverpool Street on Saturday and we'd been to a restaurant and the guy that owned the restaurant gave us some food to take home for our kids and also gave me a bottle of whiskey. And so I had like 3 bags, the kind of paper bags full of food. So I'm walking through and my front heel went. Like, because I've gone out for our anniversary, I was dressed smart, had like, you know, some nice shoes on and that, and the heel just went. And so I literally I looked like I was doing some kind of, my upper half was doing, because I didn't want the three bags to hit the floor. So my arms kind of went up in the Karate Kid kind of crane pose whilst my fucking front heel just went full splits. And like literally, but didn't sort of then topple to the left, got stuck in that situation. So I'm there, literally everybody is now pointing and pissing themselves. And like my missus has took a bag off me like I was like a pensioner that had a fall.
And I tried to kind of get back up. Hurt my knee in it, so I kind of hobbled.
In actual pain as well.
Yeah.
But you have to, it's an immediate thing to make sure no one realises you've actually hurt yourself.
If there was a curtain, Ben, I would have gone under it, man.
Yeah, get out of there.
Oh, I can't imagine that. Like, sort of like having a really not great set, and then you can't negotiate a curtain, and you can feel people's eyes on the back of you.
I think when I look back on it, I think 10 years of doing stand up, I very rarely ever invited my friends. Not until probably the last couple of years, when I just knew I'm not fucking dying. It's just not something I do anymore.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think all those years that they missed, like, amazing nights, legendary nights, nights where I turned the room around, did amazing things, and there was nobody I knew to witness it.
Was these nights when you checked, like, entrances to the stage and exits from the stage,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly, yeah.
And I think you tied a rope round your waist.
Yeah. I think if I'm honest with myself, it was probably a subconscious decision based on exactly what you just said. Yeah. This is something that I'm good at every night. Mm. So the audacity of this venue and this curtain to kill me in this moment, you know, I'm good. That's what you want to scream when you're dying. I'm actually good at this. You should have seen me last night. It's fucking amazing. Do you know what I mean? And I think, it's probably subconsciously, it's a fear, because the only thing in my mind that could make a death worse, make a bad stand-up gig worse, is if I had a family member or a friend in the room. Mm. Because, like, my mum's one of the few people who's seen me struggle. She's seen me die once, and when she saw me die, when I came off, she was like, "So what are you gonna do now?" I was like, "What? I'm gonna get some food." And she was like, "No, like, I mean, in terms of..."
Oh, that's terrible.
Like, your career.
That is brutal.
Like, what are you gonna do?
Fuck.
I was like, "No, Ma. It was a terrible gig. I died, but..." Like, that's it doesn't end, like, with a terrible gig. I'll have a good gig tomorrow.
Yeah.
She's like, but, like, nobody laughed. Like, what, you know, what happens now?
that's brutal. Yeah,
that's the welcome to the life of a comic, man.
Your mum really caring, you know. Your mum's not trying to destroy you in that moment. But
no, she's genuinely like, you know, my son's in trouble. Like, how do I help?
We might need to look at other options.
What do you do now? Really rough.
Yeah.
No, was horrible. Because obviously you did a lot of rapping and rap battles before that must have helped. Did that help?
Yeah, it did.
Because you've got to be confident, especially like when Pip started and he started and we were going around and I was watching him do a lot of like the spoken word circuit and that. It takes a lot to do that properly and also command a room, because you really need to as a poet, don't you? So is that something you sort of, you had an advantage at least?
100%. The first gig I ever did, no one laughed at all and I didn't even notice.
Sorry, mate.
This is the amazing thing about my first gig. Yeah. I didn't notice or care that nobody laughed. That's how confident I was.
Yeah.
Like, I'd been working for Lenny Henry, writing gags. I'd never done stand-up before. And the producer of this show, the sitcom for Lenny, he'd encouraged me to come to this night. Rudy's Rare Records. He'd encouraged me to come to this night where it's just BBC people and they're trying out scripts, comedy scripts, and they'll have a comedian who hosts it. You know, so it was like industry people, so it's fine. You know, he was like, go and try and do stand-up. I was like, what? I don't even know how that works. And he's like, well, you know, just get up there and tell your story. And at this point, I'd not really watched any stand-up. So I didn't even know really the laws of it. And I remember the host saying to me, do like 7 or 8. And I was like, 7 or 8 what, like jokes? He's like, no, minutes, do like 7 or 8 minutes. And I was like, oh, all right. And I got up and I was just telling them stories, like, humorous stories about my experience working with Lenny.
You hadn't like, prepped nothing?
No, nothing. Like, I'm talking to you now. And my body language, this is the thing like we were saying about body language before, my body language was so at ease that the crowd was just sort of with me. And they were too polite to boo, and because it wasn't a proper comedy gig, like circuit gig where everyone had paid and whatnot, they were just sort of like looking at me, and I was so sure in my eyes. They were like, this is definitely going somewhere. I don't know where it's going, but it's going somewhere. Like, he knows what he's doing. And it got to the end, and the guy was like, okay, that's your time. And I was like, okay, thanks. I just walked off, and people were like, what? I didn't even get a chance like, to give
him
a
like, give so him, weird. Gave him half a hand job, and then he just walked off the stage.
It was a really odd atmosphere. And I came off, and the producer was like, yeah, you know, if that was a talk, it would have been really interesting. But you got to write some jokes. You got to write some jokes. Come back and write some jokes. So it's only really when I started writing jokes that I started dying, because the expectation is different.
Yeah,
you're expecting a reaction from this thing that you say, and that changed everything. You know, so it's kind of weird when I think about it in those terms. You know, it's only the understanding of comedy that made me die. Before that, was fine. But that confidence, to bring it back around to your question, for that very first gig, it came directly from the fact that I battled people. Like I've been in situations where you could battle for £500 and then win the £500 and the dude would just kick the shit out of you, take the £500 back. Do you know what I mean?
Jeez.
Like, you know, you're dealing with like a street culture after hours in intense surroundings, you know. And when you're young, you're a teenager or whatever, like, it's everything. It's everything.
Yeah.
With this, I was just like, I'm not scared of these guys. These guys, like, work for the BBC. I didn't feel scared or pressured or anything like that. And that was definitely because I just thought I've been in more difficult situations than that. It's only when I started to understand what you had to do to be a comedian that I started getting scared.
And actually, that probably helps, right? Because then if you get scared and you're taking it seriously, you're going to write better stuff.
Yeah,
you've got
definitely.
To take the shit seriously.
My writing got better and better. My performances got better and better because of the fear of death. I just didn't want to risk it.
Yeah.
I didn't want to have a 30 seconds in my set that was boring or not funny because I was terrified. I was terrified of dying.
How long after that first gig did you wait, Ben? Like, till you done it again? Was there like a did you then think, right, I now...
It was whenever the next one of those was. So I think maybe they did it monthly or every 3 weeks or something like that. And I came down and did it again. And nothing I said really landed. But this time I had an ace up my sleeve. Because so I panicked and I said to the crowd, right, all right, let me show you something. Like, give me like a place name. Your place name, and people were like putting their hands up, shouting names of places. Like, give me something. What's your name? What's your name? And give me names. Got names of like five people, names of like five places. Objects. Show me some objects. Hold up some objects. A lighter, you know, a packet of Rizzlers, a wallet. And then I just did a freestyle, like a rap, incorporating all those things. I hadn't rapped at that point in my two gig career. I just did a freestyle. It's an old trick. Like, and in rap, it would be hack as fuck. But in comedy, it was like, that moment was like, oh my God.
No, definitely,
like
to make it funny as well.
Just done like close hand magic. That's unreal. And that's how my act sort of was born. It was born out of the fear of dying again. Like, you know, just that pressure moment. Like, I need to do something entertaining. So I did it. And yeah, that was it. Changed everything, really.
It did change everything, really, Doc. You are now on Hardcore Listing Podcast. It doesn't get any higher than this, or better, or worse. That was part one. This is 76, doing the outro to part one, because many, many reasons, all of which are valid. Anyway, that was part one. Shouts to the Distraction Pieces Network, Susie Gage, Jim Smallman, Jason Tron, Brett Goldstein, Stu, Chris, Brad, Scroobius, Pip, and all them good ones. Go check out all the other podcasts because they're banging. Until then, stay tuned for part two, which drops probably tomorrow.
It's a drunken soiree in the Within. Chris and Stu present Hardcore Listing, the podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership.
dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.